Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program that addresses regional and national issues from a Central Coast perspective. This program addresses the need for change, its consequences, and how today's choices impact tomorrow's community. This week on Central Coast Voices, host Chris Kington Barker is joined by guests from the Pacific Legal Foundation, a public interest law firm that defends Americans' liberties when threatened by government overreach and abuse. They'll be discussing how every year they represent hundreds of Americans, free of charge, who seek to improve their lives but are obstructed by the government. How PLG gives them their day in court to vindicate their rights and set a lasting precedent to protect everyone else. The second half of the show will focus on current cases that specifically impact California. You are encouraged to join the discussion, ask your questions, or bring your comments into today's show by calling 805-781-3875. Over to you, Chris.
Thank you so much. Many of you may not be familiar with the Pacific Legal Foundation, but you've likely heard of their work or seen their name in the news from time to time. In the first half of today's hour, I'm joined by Anastasia Bowden, Constitutional Scholarship Director and Senior Legal Analyst for PLF, to help us understand the organization's vast body of work and representation across the U.S., including the Central Coast. In the second half hour, Caleb Trotter, Senior Attorney, Equality and Opportunity for the Pacific League Foundation, will join me to talk about some of his specific cases in California that will have an impact on you. Anastasia, I'd like to say thank you for joining us today.
So great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, I think the first thing that I want to talk about is, who is the Pacific League Foundation and kind of when did it start and why did it get its start?
Sure. Well, PLF sues the government when the government violates people's rights, and we do it for free. And we do it because we believe that the Constitution's enduring truths of equality before the law and individual freedoms lead to a better society full of ingenuity and innovation and personal security and dignity. So if we think about something that I know is of particular concern to you and your listeners, which is healthcare, we want people to be free to perform at the top of their training. And we want individuals to be able to innovate in medicine, to increase access, to, you know, present new products and services to the market, to bring up quality and bring down prices. And we think that's achievable when we preserve our constitutional freedoms, and we try to sue the government when they get in the way. But in terms of your question about how we started, PLF was founded in 1973 in Sacramento, California, of course, because while there were some public interest law firms at the time, there was no one bringing a really consistent and what we might call libertarian voice in the courts. And so we were started during a period when many people felt that courts and agencies were unduly expanding government authority in ways that threatened people's property rights, economic liberty, and separation of powers. And there was no one really standing up in those particular areas. We see a lot of organizations devoted to just free speech or maybe religious freedoms, but we don't always see many organizations who litigate in the area of property rights, economic freedom, again, separation of powers. And so that's what PLF was started to do. And then in the intervening 50 years, we've grown into one of the nation's leading public interest law firms. And now we litigate in state and federal courts across the country, including 20 cases before the Supreme Court. But that's why we have this name, Pacific Legal Foundation. That's because we started on the West Coast, even though now we are more known for being a national law firm.
So exactly how large is your organization? How many people do you have within the organization? How many states do you exist in? And where are your locations?
Yeah, well, it's funny because PLF has grown a lot. When I started, our headquarters was in Sacramento. You know, all of us could fit in that office. You had to live in Sacramento to work at PLF. Hmm. But now PLF has more than 60 attorneys and somewhere around 140 employees, I believe, nationwide. And we're not just attorneys. We are also researchers, communications professionals, you know, legal support, and much more. And we have offices across the country. So not just in California, but also in Florida and Washington, D.C. But actually, most of our staff works from home. And our attorneys, you know, can litigate anywhere in the country. Right now, we have cases ongoing in over 25 states. Last I checked, our caseload was over 200 cases, direct rep cases. That's where we represent clients directly. And then 70 amicus cases. That's where we write briefs to the court as a friend of the court, so to speak, to try to get them to rule one way or another. So a really far reach now. And like I said, you know, 20 cases before the Supreme Court, including one that's pending just this term.
And for the people that you represent, you're representing general citizens, not just large corporations, correct?
Oh, that's right. We represent anyone, and typically just ordinary Americans whose rights are being threatened. You know, maybe they're being threatened with having their business taken away or their license taken away or their home or their property. You know, people who just want to build on their property, repair their property, or rent and sell their property, and they face restrictions on that. Very often, especially in my own personal practice group and career, small business owners who are just trying to start up, but they face anti-competitive regulations that are there not because they protect the general public, but usually because they protect incumbents from new competition. But students, parents, you know, workers, it's usually individual people from all walks of life and all political backgrounds who need to fight back. And they wouldn't do so absent pro bono representation. That's the key. We are a nonprofit. And, you know, we take these cases because people either don't have the means to themselves or they wouldn't pursue these constitutional claims because they don't have enough of a financial interest in it to go hire very expensive attorneys. So we step in, you know, and do it for free when people can't do it for themselves.
And how are cases brought to your attention? And then how do you select which ones you're going to follow through with?
Well, they come to us in many different ways. Sometimes people contact us directly. Sometimes attorneys or others refer potential cases to us. We are also constantly monitoring emerging legal issues, regulatory trends, you know, cases and types of cases that we care about so that we can stay in the know and offer pro bono representation when we think people might need it. But how we evaluate a case is, well, we look to several different factors. The first being whether it's within our wheelhouse. We only have certain practice groups. So we have property rights. We have equality and opportunity. We have separation of powers. And then we have environmental and natural resources law. So it has to fit into one of those four types of things. Okay. But then once we get there, then we want to look to whether it's a public interest case, you know, whether there's a meaningful constitutional issue that's going to set precedent, important precedent that's going to protect not just the rights of the people in any one case, but the rights of ordinary Americans across the country. We want to know whether the client has a compelling story. You know, I mean, judges are human, let's face it, and stories matter. And so we want these stories that are going to illustrate to courts and to the general public what's at stake here. You know, we don't want to just talk in constitutional, boring constitutional terms. I mean, not boring to me because I'm a constitutional attorney. But to many other people, some of these issues might seem very dense. And it's only through the stories of our clients that these issues come alive and you know, really tell people what's at stake. And then, you know, lastly, I think it's often said in law that bad facts make bad law. And we're bolder, I think, than a lot of other organizations. We'll take hard cases. But ultimately, we need to neatly present issues that are core to our expertise and priorities and that aren't going to get clouded by other things. Like sometimes clients might have, you know, they need to bring 10 claims. And frankly, we're only in a place to exercise or our core competencies. So there has to be an alignment of interests between our clients and you know, what we exist to do and why people support us and give us money to do what we do.
Do you find sometimes that you have multiple people that end up being having their cases be relevant to one situation that you're going to take into court?
It is funny that if I understand your question, you know, sometimes we have one client and that sets precedent in one area, but it brings so much publicity to the case that then we get a bunch of calls
about
from across
similar
the country,
situations.
People saying, hey, we have that too. And then we also have clients who have become repeat clients because we've helped them get a business started, which is an amazing feeling. And then later down the line, their business runs into another roadblock that they never would have seen coming at the outset. But, you know, it only came to them once they were able to open their doors. So, yeah, there's a lot of repeating patterns, I think, with our work.
How do people generally come to you and bring cases to you? How do they find out about you?
You know, usually I find that people find themselves in some sort of difficult situation, you know, a pickle, they get a threatening letter, whatever it may be, or maybe they're trying to start up and they realize they don't even know how to. There's all these regulations that they don't know how to navigate, and they Google it and they see our past cases or, you know, articles about us or our name. It's people who come into an everyday problem that they wouldn't have translated themselves to a constitutional problem. They didn't understand it that way, right? But when they Google it, they see, hey, there's a constitutional law firm out there, and this has a constitutional claim that we can bring to court. So that's something that I see a lot.
If someone wanted to bring a case to you, how would they start? Would they go to your website?
Yeah, absolutely. We encourage everyone to reach out, you know, no matter if you think it's unlikely or not, let us be the judge of that. Please come to our website. There's a form you can fill out. Somebody will reach out to you and get more facts, and then we can determine whether we are able to take it. But yeah, you absolutely submitting through the website. You know, I get emails all the time from people who see something I've written or whatever, and then they email me and just say, I have this issue. You know, I'm at an event sometimes speaking, and then somebody afterwards will say, you wouldn't believe this happened to me.
Yeah.
And so anything, there's tons of ways, but the best way is probably our website, because we can get back to you really quickly that way.
We have a question from Michael in Cayucas. I'm going to bring Michael on. Michael, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hi, Michael. Did you have a question for Anastasia?
Yes, hello. How are you listening to your show? I enjoy Central Coast Voices and KCPX. Longtime San Luis Obispo resident. I'm 68 years old.
Well, welcome.
Married.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you. Sure, thanks for the show. You guys really do a great job. Your guest is ideal for my situation, okay? It's very, very similar. I'm a retired journalist with years of journalism. About 2021, I was using a product known as Artificial Tears, which was in the headlines and is still in the headlines, as it was a product tampering thing, supposedly. I used the product. CDC, FDA reported some 60 or 70 people were harmed by it. Some of them died. Some of them lost their eyesight. I was rushed to Stanford Medical, and today I'm profoundly blind. And we haven't been able to get any activity or lawsuit. And this is where your guest, Anastasia, hello, Anastasia, would have at least, I'd probably go on the website. And, you know, I'm not asking for an interview at this time. But what would be the chances? We filed formally with the FDA, and we're working with Congressman Carbajal, locally, going back and forth. And all the lawyers, there's nothing we can do. There's nothing we can do. So I don't know. I could tell you more, but that's the short version. It's miserable.
Yeah, I'm so sorry that happened to you. And I have to say, it's unfortunately, we hear this a lot. Just people are frustrated. They can't get movement on things. They can't find anyone to represent them. I would say, you know, with PLF, I'll tell you, we sue the government. So we don't sue private parties. We sue the government when they are overreaching in ways that deprive people of
right,
a right that we think that they have. So I don't know that particular case
would
fit. But like I said, we always encourage people to reach out anyway. And we may be able to connect you with someone else, even if we can't take the case. We have a lot of connections. You know, we know a lot of attorneys. So we always encourage people to reach out.
Sure. Well, and one thing that I was told by people I talked to is that it's impossible to sue the government. The lawsuit would be toward negligence for not testing the product properly and not protecting the public from consumer products. And, of course, all these products, these are medical products. This is an eye lubricant. Goes in your body. Well, it wasn't tested properly, so a lawsuit might succeed. Do you think or no? I mean, FDA, they told me all they said, nobody sues the FDA. So
Well, you know, I can't be in the business of giving out legal advice on the radio, but I will tell you this. Yeah. It is very difficult to sue the government, but that is our entire job. The decks are stacked against people who try to sue the government in a lot of ways. And I think courts have become far too fearful of pushing back against government overreach. But certainly that's why we exist, and we're not scared of a fight. And it's tough work, but someone's got to do it. So don't let that get you down.
I'm very glad people like you are available, and we have heard. And by that I mean professionals who understand the Byzantine nature of we couldn't get a lawyer. I mean, it took a year before I was even aware of the artificial tears scandal. We had many lawyers who spoke with us. And at first they were very eager, saying, well, shoot, you lost your eyesight. It's an over-the-counter product. It's like Roundup. I mean, what's your take on those products? What else? Tylenol?
So, Michael, one of the things that Anastasia is saying is you probably should go on to the website and make contact with them. Yeah. She doesn't know that she can help you, but worth you actually going to the website and making contact. Is that what you're saying, Anastasia?
That's exactly right. We'll have someone evaluate it and see if there's any angle for us. Like I said, our work is pretty narrow in terms of our practice areas, but we're always happy to take a look.
Okay. Thank you for calling, Michael. Too. Good luck.
Yeah. Thank you as well. It'll be okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And I'm Chris Kington-Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. My guest today is Anastasia Bowden, Constitutional Scholarship Director and Senior Legal Analyst for the Pacific League Foundation. Our topic today is the Pacific League Foundation, a public interest law firm that defends American liberties when threatened by government overreach and abuse. Every year, representing hundreds of Americans free of charge who seek to improve their lives but are obstructed by the government. If you want to join our discussion, as Michael just did, you can call us at 805-781-3875. And Anastasia, when we were talking about the kinds of cases, like you were saying, that some things your organization doesn't take, can you talk about just kind of the array, give some examples of the kind of cases that you have represented? I know that, for instance, the PLF has had cases against the Coastal Commission here on the Central Coast.
That's right. And in fact, one of our cases against the Coastal Commission is one of our Supreme Court wins. So that's a big one. It's a foundational case in constitutional law, having to do with when the government burdens your right to build on your property. Here we had a client who had a small beach bungalow that they wanted to expand. And the government said, in order to get that permit, we are going to force you to give public access to your property so that people can cross your property to get to the beach. And our clients didn't want to do that. It was very intrusive. Again, it's a small beach bungalow and not a large property. And to have people walking across their property was an invasion of privacy. I mean, they have children. It's something that they felt was unfair. And so they sued. And what the result was at the Supreme Court was the Supreme Court said, anytime the government puts some sort of condition on your ability to use your property, it has to be proportional and related to any harm that you're causing by use of your property. So sure, if you're going to do something to your property that's going to cause the public harm, the government can ask you to remediate that harm, right? Or to pay for it. But any sort of condition has to actually have some relevance to what you're trying to do. And if you're just trying to, you know, build on your own beach bungalow, there's no reason for the government to say that now they can use you as an ATM machine and impose this exaction of of requiring you to force the public across it. So yes, we sue the California Coastal Commission all the time. I myself have brought many healthcare cases, actually challenging certificate of need laws, which we call competitors' veto laws. These are laws that say that if you want to start a new medical service or even sometimes just buy new medical equipment, so if you want to add a hospital bed or if you want to buy a new MRI machine for your small practice, you have to prove to the government that it's needed. But the way that the government does that is by asking all of your competitors whether they think it's needed. So effectively, it gives them a veto over your business, whether
and those
you're
are your competitors,
able to open
right?
Your doors. Right, exactly right. When are they ever going to say yes that you need to do more business? They're never, and they don't. They never say yes, right? They
right.
always veto.
Right.
So that's something that we've challenged quite a bit. As I mentioned, we have a Supreme Court case pending this year. Right now, we're waiting for the decision any day now, having to do with a family whose house was seized to pay a disputed property tax that they say they never owed. It's a very small debt, $2,200. And the county took the home and sold it, which they are allowed to do. But the Supreme Court has said they have to give you anything above what you owe the government back, right? So if you owe $2,200 and your home was sold for $200,000, they have to give you the difference between $200,000 and $2,200. They can't just steal all your equity. And that principle was actually established by a previous PLF case. So here now we know that this family gets that money back. But what the problem was they're going to get the money back, which is great. But what the problem is that the county sold the house for far less than what it was worth. The house was worth $200,000, and it sold it for less than half that, $76,000. So now they're only getting, what's that, you know, $70,000 in equity back. Basically, the county wiped out this family's home equity, and we're saying that's unfair. If you're going to sell a house to get some, you know, to recoup what's owed to you as the government in the form of a tax debt, you have to sell it at a fair price, and not under conditions which lead to it being drastically undervalued. Otherwise, the government's just stealing your home equity from you. And as I'm sure everyone knows, especially in California, you know, home equity, it's something that is important. It's houses are expensive here. It's people save, you know, in order
it's
to be able to buy a home.
It's where their savings is, frankly.
Yeah, that's exactly. And people are relying on that for retirement or for college or for cars. Who knows?
Right.
But home equity needs to be preserved. And so that's something that we're fighting for right now.
The for the different kinds of cases that you do, are you doing your cases specific to California or do you do them for nationwide?
Yeah, we can sue anywhere. We can sue in states and federal courts across the country. I live in California, and I have brought many cases in California, but we are not limited to that. Okay. We'll go wherever the injustice is. But of course, I'm passionate about helping bring Californians justice because I was born and raised here, and I went to school not too far from you in Santa Barbara. So, you know, that's definitely a passion of mine.
Talk a little bit about how you've interacted as an organization with the Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, we are lucky enough to have had 20 cases, and again, a case pending this term, because the Supreme Court actually only grants 1% of the cases that people ask it to grant. So that's a really, really, really low grant rate.
Of all the cases in the nation, you're talking about
1%? In the nation.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1% that are asked to be, that people actually petition to the Supreme Court. Of those that are brought to the Supreme Court only agrees to hear 1%. So it's very hard to get a case granted. And so we do interact with the court in other ways. We write briefs, amicus briefs, they're called, to the Supreme Court, telling them why we think the justices should rule in a certain way, you know, offering our expertise or showing our cases as examples, you know, telling the court, hey, this is the real world effect, please rule in this way. We do quite a bit of constitutional scholarship, so publishing law review articles and explainers, trying to translate Supreme Court decisions to the public so there's better public education around the Supreme Court. You know, there's many ways that we can try to help shape constitutional doctrine, even if we don't have our cases before the court, because, again, it's just so hard to get them there.
A lot of people hear about the ACLU and a lot of the cases that they bring, or a lot of cases that they get involved in representing. How are you different, and how do you work with the ACLU in terms of the work that you do?
Yeah, I think we're all part of the legacy of the nonprofit strategic legal foundation movement. We all exist. We are donor supported. We're nonprofits, but we all exist because we have a specific mission. And so we are not too unlike the ACLU in the sense that we represent people for free. We do it because we're trying to get to the Supreme Court and set, you know, constitutional precedent. We're different from them because we have a different practice area. You know, we don't specialize in free speech, although we do bring many free speech cases when they're sort of adjacent to our practice groups. Mm-hmm. But even then, you know, sometimes we might disagree on the scope of free speech. You know, we want free speech for everyone, including for businesses. You know, we care about commercial speech. That's something that, you know, as far as I know, the ACLU is less passionate about. So we might disagree on what those doctrines look like or what type of cases we take. But I think we have the same sort of soul in a way, which is, you know, this passion and idea driven litigation that's aiming to change the world, really.
Yeah. When we talk about the kind of cases that you take on, can you give an example of a case that might fall under something that's being worked on right now with separation of powers?
Oh, yeah. So many, because, in fact, that's, you know, it's incredible to me how much there's been a rise of what we call the fourth branch of government. Mm-hmm. There is not just the judicial branch and the executive branch and the legislative branch. There's now thousands of administrative agencies who are really no longer accountable to anybody. And so they constitute their own fourth branch of government. And we're trying to push back against that. We've had several cases. I'm trying to think of what maybe our most salient ones are. But typically the theme would be these agencies are making up rules rather than that being really the prerogative of the legislative branch. We want the legislative branch to be making laws because we can vote them out if they make laws that we disagree with. But instead, the Congress recently has been perfectly content to delegate their job, truly their core competency, to administrative agencies and bureaucrats who come up with these rules themselves and enforce them at, you know, very largely unaccountable to the president or the executive branch. They can't be fired easily, so there's no accountability. And we're trying to restore sort of some of that political accountability and bring back the separation of power so that each person is doing their job. Another problem that happens is not only are these agencies making the laws themselves, coming up with the laws themselves, but they're also enforcing them through in-house tribunals. So these agencies become, you know, judge, jury, and executioner, and the same people who are deciding whether you're guilty, these in-house judges, not federal judges, not independent judges that work for the agency, are working alongside the people who came up with the laws and who are enforcing the laws. I mean, that's a pretty crazy perversion of powers. It's something we think is totally un-American, right? Everyone has a right to a jury trial usually, before an impartial adjudicator. So that's another one of our big passions at PLF, is making sure that if you do get ensnared in some dispute with the government, that you get an impartial adjudicator, and there's no thumb on the scale in favor of one party, typically the government, or another.
Well, given that that's an area that you're taking very seriously, you're going to be very busy these days in that area.
That's exactly right.
And I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the air with me today, Anastasia, and to talk about this. We could talk about so much more. And I'm going to take a break right now. And I thank you for being here. We're going to be talking to your colleague, Caleb, in just a minute. And thank you for being here today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Right. And we're going to take a quick moment to go to identification and then come back with Caleb Trotter.
Next time on Latino USA, I speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Caitlin Dickerson of The Atlantic. She breaks down the latest news about the conditions children held in detention are facing and why some mixed-status families are choosing to leave. That's next time on Latino USA.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Rose Byrne. She's nominated for a Tony for her leading role in the revival of Noel Coward's Fallen Angels. She was nominated for an Oscar for her role in the film If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. She co-starred in the films Bridesmaids, Spy, and Neighbors, and in the TV shows Platonic and Damages. Join us.
Trade wars, as we all know, have become the new normal.
Parties weaponizing trade flows, using trade to coerce other actors, make others do what they want. It's a scary world out there.
Indeed it is. I'm Kai Rizdahl. How, though, does one win a trade war? We'll get into it next time on Marketplace.
Ahead on our Thursday here on KCBX, it's Latino USA up at 2, Fresh Air at 3, and then Marketplace at 4. Right now, let's return to Chris Kington Barker and her guest on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Chris.
Welcome back. Joining me for the second half of the hour is Caleb Trotter, Senior Attorney, Equality and Opportunity with the Pacific League Foundation. And some of his recent cases have included challenging current laws regulating out-of-state telemedicine for California residents. Caleb is here to talk about some of those restrictions, including SB 1002, a two-page bill that costs nothing and requires no new bureaucracy. Go figure all of that. And ensures cancer survivors don't lose their doctors the moment they have entered remission. And welcome, Caleb. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
Oh, it's great. We just got through talking with Anastasia, who was talking about the great work that your organization does. And you're handling some really interesting cases right now. We mentioned that you're handling, are you doing specifically equality and opportunity right now?
Yeah, that's what I went to law school to do many years ago, and that's what I exclusively do now.
Well, it certainly sounds really interesting. Could you talk a little bit about how the cases that you're handling for telemedicine fall under free speech? And a little bit about the cases.
Yeah, happy to do so. So telemedicine at its core is a conversation between a patient and a physician when both are at a distance from each other. There's no surgery being performed, no, you know, using a hammer to poke a knee or something like that. All that's happening is a conversation, usually over the phone, more and more frequently over video. And because all that's happening in typically in these consultations and then a follow-up is a conversation, that is protected speech. The U.S. Supreme Court in a recent case just a couple months ago said that even talk therapy, where the conversation is the treatment itself, is speech that's protected by the First Amendment. And for the government to put licensing restrictions or prohibitions on the types of conversations that a patient or client can have with a medical professional is still protected by the First Amendment. And so in the context of our telehealth cases, we have one that's currently pending in California, another in New Jersey. The context of those cases is you have patients with exceptionally rare diseases and cancers, and they're so rare that there is no physician with the expertise or the resources to treat those conditions local to those patients. So they have to seek out truly national specialists to address those diseases and conditions. And before somebody flies around the country to find these specialists or to go for in-person treatment, oftentimes what they want to do is consult to make sure it's appropriate to do so. And then if it is, and they go and get that in-person treatment after they return home, there's also usually a need to have follow-up conversations just to make sure things are going well and talk about any issues that may come up. But because of the way medical licensure operates in the United States on a state-by-state basis, at least 30 states still post-COVID require the physician to be licensed in every single state that a patient would be located, even to have just that basic conversation. And so that's what we're challenging, is the ability of patients and physicians to just simply talk to each other to see if in-person treatment is necessary, and to follow up on that after the patient returns home.
And it's a, I understand it. I was doing a little bit of research before the show. California is one of the most restrictive states.
That's true. California is definitely in the minority in the country that did not waive any of the licensure restrictions during the pandemic. Many states, once the pandemic really got going, recognized either that they needed more help to help patients suffering from COVID or dealing with it, but also just generally in the medical sphere. And so they waived the requirement for a physician to have to get a full-fledged medical license in that state just to have, you know, telehealth care. Some of them allowed like some kind of a registry, just was very simple. You could be, you know, credentialed within a day, but not in California. California never lessened the requirement that you have to get a full-fledged medical license, even for temporary telehealth. And California hasn't even joined the Interstate Medical Compact, which, while still pretty burdensome, is slightly more streamlined than having to go state by state. I think it's correct that California, while they don't ban telehealth, I'm not aware of any state that just outright bans it. But short of that, they certainly do have, if not the most restrictive, certainly they're up there and being one of the most restrictive states in regards to interstate telehealth.
And so the patients that you're representing, I mean, one of the patients is someone who, when they went into remission, you know, they want to be able to have conversations with their physician while they're in remission, and they cannot, right?
Yeah, that's one of the most absurd aspects and results of these licensure regimes, is that after the patient has left home, they've sought out in-person treatment, and that's been successful, and they have an established patient-physician relationship. When they return home, the state mandates that relationship end. And it's, no one has benefited from that,
right.
I think it's at best short-sighted and just a failure to imagine and recognize what these licensure regimes, how they're operating in 2026 in a world that now expects and is used to telehealth being available. Honestly, before the pandemic, telehealth was certainly not nearly as prevalent. The infrastructure wasn't there with physicians and health systems to use it at scale. But that's the world we live in now, and the state's failure to adopt their laws to recognize that is frankly inexcusable here now,
right,
6 years later. The context of just simply wanting to stay in touch with your specialist physician who you only saw in the first place because your local physicians didn't know how to treat your condition or have the resources to do so, there's just no valid explanation for that being the law. And yet here we are, the vast majority of states still have that restriction in place in the year 2026.
Well, in reality, too, what we have now is we have a situation where you've got mega centers that are specializing in different diseases that have the number of patients that visit them that require the treatment, and they can get the best of the best equipment that is very expensive, and the people to operate the equipment at these centralized centers that are in specific areas, sometimes specific states, but not all states are going to have them. And certainly California has a plethora of people living here, but we don't have all the resources here. And so a lot of people do have to go out of state for treatment, for sometimes not even obscure diseases, but for cancers or other diseases that there are treatments that are available now, but not available here.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. Our New Jersey case that I mentioned earlier, one of our clients there is a Massachusetts radiation oncologist, and she deals with what's called proton therapy. And about a decade ago, when our client, who is a patient of her, was an infant, there were fewer than 10 hospitals in the country that had the ability to conduct proton therapy. Imagine just a very, very small laser beam that delivers radiation. It's particularly useful in certain brain tumors, especially for young children, where you don't want to damage any of the surrounding healthy tissue.
Right.
But because of this, the specialty of this treatment, and there being fewer than 10 hospitals, that was largely because I believe the machine costs around $500 million, at least it did about a decade ago. And so you can just imagine, there are obviously going to be very few health systems able to have those kinds of facilities.
Right.
These restrictions do limit the ability of patients to access that and maintain that ongoing care after the fact.
Well, and the thing is it that the physician who wanted to practice telemedicine with his patient, for every patient that he saw outside of his state, he would have to have a license for another state in order to see those patients if those states didn't recognize his license?
That's right, Chris. The way
it's crazy.
Medical licensure works, in at least the United States, is what's relevant is where the patient is located. So if you're a national or global specialist, and you reasonably expect that you could have a patient call you or walk in the door from anywhere in the country, mm-hmm. then yes, it is reasonable to expect that you're going to need a lot of state licenses, maybe as much as 50, which is practically the burdens. Someone did the math and added it up. If you just at the outset, so the initial fees, it would exceed $90,000 to be licensed in all 50 states.
Right.
And that doesn't even consider the ongoing renewal fees, the continuing education,
right.
and all the monitoring that would have to go in just to manage that. Like, it would be completely unmanageable, especially for someone whose job is to provide specialty medical care. They wouldn't also need a full-time job just to manage their licenses.
Exactly.
And it's even more absurd that it would apply if, say, you live in the state where your physician is, but you go out of town for work or for vacation, and an issue arose and you needed to call that doctor. Well, many health systems, out of an abundance of caution with being fearful of regulators, are going to ask that patient, okay, where are you physically located right now? And if you report that you're in a state that the physician isn't licensed in, they will end the call. And that has happened. It's still happening. So that you couldn't even go out of town for a couple days and talk to your doctor just highlights the absurdity of using the patient's location to determine whether they can access specialty medical care or, frankly, any telehealth.
Where is that case right now, Caleb?
Yeah, so both the California and New Jersey cases are both on appeal in the federal courts of appeals. Early on, both of the states moved to dismiss, just saying that there was no viable claim here. In addition to bringing First Amendment claims in both cases, we also have a Commerce Clause challenge because these regimes are restricting interstate telehealth, so the use of telehealth across state lines. But what we fully expect is because of that Supreme Court decision I mentioned a few minutes ago, from just a couple months ago, that said that even talk therapy is protected speech. We are hopeful that both of the courts in this case will recognize that, yes, we do have a First Amendment claim here, because what our patients and physicians are doing isn't even treatment. It's just a consultation and a follow-up. But if even speech that is therapy is treatment and that's protected by the First Amendment, then certainly a consultation and follow-up before and after treatment must also be protected by the First Amendment. So we're hopeful that in some number of months, we'll get decisions from those courts letting us go back to the district court to fight out the merits of those claims.
You are also handling a case that started here in San Luis Obispo for a nurse practitioner. Can you talk a little bit about that case?
Yeah, I think you're referring to perhaps Sarah Ernie.
Sarah Ernie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so she was a nurse practitioner in California, and she had a thriving practice, and she ran afoul of what was at least then an obscure California law that says only physicians and surgeons can refer to themselves as a doctor.
Right.
She's a nurse practitioner, but she has her doctorate degree.
Right. And she got a doctorate, right? Yes.
Right. And so, like pretty much everyone who has a doctorate, they use the initials DR and they refer to themselves as doctor. She also always clarified that she wasn't a medical doctor, but was a nurse practitioner with a doctorate, and patients appreciated that. They understood that meant she had the most education that a nurse could have.
Right.
And yet the California Medical Board and Nursing Board prosecuted her for that and essentially ran her out of the state. They fined her upwards of $25,000. And so because she decided to leave the state to continue her practice, and to be clear, no one was harmed or confused or misled by anything.
No, nobody, none of her patients complained, right?
Exactly. This was simply the state monopolizing the use of a term and initials that many people other than just physicians use. But so we found a number of other nurse practitioners who also have doctorates to challenge this law. And basically on the First Amendment grounds that what they are doing is truthful. They have doctorate degrees. They are clarifying to their patients that they are not physicians. So no one is confused and no one is harmed. And that case is also currently pending in court. And we'll hopefully have a decision by next year.
Yeah, that one struck me for a number of reasons. I thought it was interesting. Certainly when there's doctorates that are used in a lot of different careers, like for library, for education, for a number of different things. So it would be interesting to follow you on that. You are listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, your listener-supported station. If you recently joined our show today and want to enjoy the entire broadcast, it's available on our website at kcbx.org. On the Listen on Demand tab, just click on Central Coast Voices and you'll find this show along with many others to choose from. Caleb Trotter, Senior Attorney, Equality and Opportunity for Pacific Legal Foundation, is my guest today. The Pacific League Foundation, a public interest law firm that defends Americans' liberties when threatened by government overreach and abuse, and some of their work is the center of our discussion today. If you want to call in, you still can at 805-781-3875. And Caleb, let's talk a little bit about the AB that you have going right now. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so there's a bill pending in the California legislature. It's SB 1002, and it's a very simple bill. Like a moment ago, we were talking about what I think is one of the most absurd results of restricting telehealth, and that's where you already have established, a patient has already established a relationship with a physician out of state for specialty treatment. They've gone and received that treatment. The treatment is working. Your condition is in remission, so you return home to heal or recover and continue. But what pretty much every patient wants to be able to do is follow up with that physician out of state to check in, to ask about any concerns that might arise. And yet, because of the way California and every state's medical licensure rules work, that you are prohibited from doing that with your physician unless that physician is licensed in California. And so one of the prime drivers behind this bill, she had a rare form of cancer, sought out treatment in Houston at MD Anderson, and then found out that, oh, well, she can't use telehealth to speak with that physician after she returned home to California. And so what this bill does, it's very simple. It amends existing California law that allows for you to engage in telehealth with an out-of-state physician who's not licensed in California if you have an immediately life-threatening disease or condition. But what this law would do is it would say also if you're in remission and have already established a relationship with that physician. So the law would make the very simple, straightforward change of allowing you to speak with your out-of-state physician on the phone when you're in remission to make sure you're managing that very carefully. I think it's a no-brainer of a bill. no one is possibly harmed from this. To the opposite, people are only benefited by this law. And it sailed through the state Senate. It's currently pending in committee in the assembly. And we're hopeful that that will come to a good result and get passed sometime this year.
Is that something that people who are listening can help get passed? Because it's not something that they'll be able to vote on, correct?
That's right. And so it's currently being considered in the state assembly. It's at the Business and Professions Committee. There's no hearing date has been set, but anyone in the state could reach out to the members of the Assembly Business and Professions Committee and voice their support for it. Even more simply, you just voice your support to your local assembly member. And that the bill, again, is SB1002. And I think it is the most common sense bill that you should be able to continue talking to your specialty physician when you return home. Like, no one is benefited by ending that relationship or requiring you to travel back out of state just to have a simple follow-up conversation that everyone knows could be done over the phone or a video
Absolutely.
Call. And so it unanimously passed the state Senate, so we're hopeful that it will receive the same treatment in the assembly. But that's pending in the assembly now, and we're hopeful that that will get passed this year.
Is this something that – are there organizations that are behind this bill, like Compassion and Choices or any of the other organizations that deal with end-of-life issues?
There is a lengthy list of groups that we were involved in helping to organize around this. I don't have it in front of me, mm-hmm. But last year, the patient I mentioned who was kind of the driving force behind this, they were not successful in getting this bill. And I think the bill originated in the California senior legislature.
Okay.
And just for whatever reason, it did not get any support last year. So they tried again this year. And we at Pacific Legal Foundation really kind of adopted their cause because of our work on the issue and have helped them form a broader coalition of support to really express to the legislature that this is an issue that everyone agrees patients need to be able to do, that physicians should be able to do. No one is harmed in California by allowing out-of-state physicians who are still licensed, by the way, and medical licensure in the United States, substantively speaking, is uniform. They have to go to the – they all have to have a degree from an accredited school. They all have to take the same national – licensure exams. So there's just no universe in which allowing a patient to speak with their out-of-state licensed physician is going to lead to harm to anyone just on those facts. And so by putting together a broad coalition, it certainly looks that message has been received loud and clear, given it passed unanimously through the state Senate.
Caleb, when COVID hit, there was a decision made to lift the limitations on telemedicine so that it could be more broadly used during the period of time of the shutdown. And then those restrictions were once again slammed down. What organizations made that decision to lift those restrictions and then to not adapt changes and to shut it back down?
Yes, I think what you mean by, you know, kind of liberalizing, freeing the ability to telehealth was just making it clear that the use of telehealth wasn't illegal in and
right.
of itself.
Right.
It's a separate question, though, and the one that we're primarily dealing with is, well, can an out-of-state physician use that same technology that's legal for California physicians to use with patients in California? And that's where California has never changed. They have never allowed out-of-state physicians to do so unless they had a duplicative license in California. But, you know, your question about, so who is making these decisions? By and large, it's the California Medical Board. They also need the state legislature to change the law on this. But I think it's reasonable to say and accurate that the state legislature certainly listens to what the state medical board wants.
Yeah.
And I think it's just abundantly clear that the California Medical Board is not exhibiting any willingness or leadership to expand the ability of state citizens to access medical expertise outside of the state unless they have their grips through licensure over that physician. And that's a position that roughly 30 other state medical boards are also doing, but for a lot of the reasons we've talked about in the last several minutes, that's really not benefiting patients at all. And in the case of patients with rare diseases and conditions, mm-hmm. it's actually actively harming them. And so we would have hoped that the legislature and the medical board could have fixed this, but they haven't. And so that's what has prompted litigation to hopefully solve the problem for them.
Well, there's also a real severe lack of understanding of the medical needs that are unmet for people in the state because they cannot be met by the providers in the state. There aren't enough providers.
That's true.
That's just a simple fact. There aren't enough physicians. There aren't enough clinicians in the state to meet the needs of Californians.
That's absolutely right. And even if we're talking about using telehealth to help rural Californians access physicians and providers in urban areas, there is still a shortage, not just in specialty medicine, but especially so. And so more broad-based acceptance from a regulatory standpoint of allowing Californians to access medical care via telehealth, regardless of where that physician is located in the country, is certainly needed, and hopefully even beyond our lawsuit, that this bill that we talked about, SB 1002, will kind of be the first salvo in the state legislature to making that access more available for all Californians.
Well, I commend you for your work. I wish you the very best, and thank you for coming today to share this information with us, Caleb. I really appreciate you doing that.
Yeah, thank you, Chris, for the opportunity, and happy to talk about it.
All right. I want to thank Caleb Trotter, Senior Attorney, Equality and Opportunity, for the Pacific Legal Foundation. I want to thank also Anastasia Bowden, Constitutional Scholarship Director and Senior Legal Analyst for the Pacific League Foundation. Next week, join Lata Murthy as she hosts her guests, Dr. Shusana Hakabayan of Shell Piano Trio and composer Dr. Dion Nielsen Price of Music for Unity as they discuss the upcoming concert, Postcards from Armenia. Speaking of music, please get your tickets for Oakfest. They're on sale now, and it's going to be wonderful. I'm Chris Kington Barker for Central Coast Voices. Thank you for joining me and for being a KCBX listener.